From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, why filing taxes is so confusing, expensive, and time-consuming. Every year, Americans pay over $10 billion to the tax preparation industry.
You can walk down the street in London, Lima, Amsterdam, Tokyo, and you'll never see an H&R Block because other countries don't need this service. They have done what the U.S. Congress evidently can't do. They've made it simple.
We talk with journalist T.R. Reid about his new book, A Fine Mess. He'll explain how our tax code got so confusing and look at how other countries do it in ways that are often simpler, fairer, and more efficient. And we'll talk about President Trump's promise to overhaul the tax code and look at the competing tax philosophies between Democrats and Republicans and Republicans and Republicans. Reid's previous books were about health care reform and the European Union. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's tax time in two ways. While those of us who are last-minute folks are either trying to make sense of the often incomprehensible tax forms or paying someone else to do it for us, the Trump administration is trying to move forward on the president's promise to overhaul the tax system. So the timing is perfect for my guest T.R. Reid's new book, A Fine Mess. The mess he refers to is our bizarrely complicated tax code. The book compares our system with those of other countries in an attempt to figure out what a simpler, fairer, and more efficient system might look like. Reid is a former Washington Post foreign correspondent and has lived with his family on three other continents. He has two previous books about subjects that remain urgent: The Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare, and The Future of the European Union. T.R. Reid, welcome back to Fresh Air. So congratulations on writing a book about taxes that I can understand, unlike tax forms, which I cannot understand. To get in the mood for this conversation, I'd like you to quote one or two of your favorite incomprehensible tax instructions from the tax forms.
I'm now doing my own taxes because I wrote a book about how hard it is.
Yeah?
Here's a gem. Enter 6% of the smaller of line 40 or the value of your Archer MSAs on December 31st, 2015, including 2015 contributions made in 2016. Include this amount on Form 1040 line 58A or Form 1040 NR line 56B. Pretty simple.
This
and
is
it doesn't have to be that way. That's what's really galling.
Well, you talk about countries where everybody does their taxes in like 15 minutes because it's that simple.
You know, I was in the Netherlands on March 31st. Their tax day is April 1st. Talking to a manager. He makes about $200,000 a year. He has a whole panoply of investments, two kids in private schools, two mortgages. He'd have to fill out 12 forms in the United States. And I said, Michael, how do you do your taxes? They're due tomorrow. He says, well, I pop a beer, I go online and see if the government's got the numbers right. And if they do, I hit a button, takes 5 minutes. He says, but, you know, sometimes I start checking the numbers. He says, you know, you start checking the numbers, it can take almost half an hour just to pay your taxes. He was outraged.
Wow. So you have your new book on tax overhaul of the Republicans are trying to figure out what their plan is going to be because there's different points of view within the party. But you think the time is really right for a true tax overhaul. You write that like every 30 or 32 years, the system is totally revised. That's not like part of the plan. It's just the way it's worked out.
That's right. It's history repeating itself. So we created the federal income tax in 1913. Very popular tax because the only people who paid it were the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts. And then it started, grew. The rates went way up to pay for World War I. In 1922, they wrote a pretty complete income tax code. By 1954, it was a mess. It had so many clauses and exclusions and exemptions that President Eisenhower said, get rid of it. They rewrote the whole thing. That was the Internal Revenue Code of 1954. By 1986, same thing. It was a total mess. Nobody could handle it. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, a conservative and a liberal, agreed to change it. They threw it out. That's the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. If you look at the pattern there, that's every 32 years. And sure enough, we're now 31 years down the line, and the thing is a total monster. It's a mess. Everybody knows we have to fix it, and the time has come.
So let's talk about some of the tax issues that directly affect individuals and families. We'll look at corporations a little later. President Trump, it's my understanding that he wants to lower personal income tax. What's his proposal for that?
Well, he wants to cut rates for all earners and particularly for people who run their own business. If you run your own business, at a certain point, you're paying 39.6% in income tax. His proposal would cut that to 15%. That's a huge boon for people who own their own company. How he's going to pay for it, he has never made clear, but there is a way to pay for this. I want to point this out, Terry. Other countries have found ways to cut the rates sharply and bring in the same revenue. And the way you do it is you get rid of all the loopholes and giveaways and escape clauses that have found their way into the tax code.
So getting back to how Trump wants to cut personal income taxes, like if you're not the owner of your own business, has he proposed lower rates for individuals and families?
Well, I'll tell you the Donald Trump tax plan for individuals. I'll quote it to you. My tax plan will be so great it'll make your head spin.
And what percentage is
that? We
don't know
the numbers.
What are the percentages?
They're said to be working on a plan, but we don't know the numbers. There's a plan floating around the House that would make three rates, 5%, 10%, and 20%. That would be a significant cut for most taxpayers. But again, they don't say how they're going to pay for it. And you can't really cut those rates sharply without a huge loss of revenue unless you change other parts of the code.
So that would be a progressive tax, but would the rich benefit more from that cut?
Yeah, if you're paying now at a 12% rate and they cut it to 10, that's a saving. But rich people are paying 39.6%. If that gets cut to 20, their tax rate goes down by half.
So you say if we cut a lot of the deductions and the loopholes and the exclusions, we could afford to cut taxes and still be ahead of the game. So one of the things that's often on the table when people talk about ending deductions is the mortgage deduction, which sounds very upsetting because for everybody who owns a home, you can deduct. Is it you deduct your mortgage or just the interest from the mortgage?
You deduct the interest, but you only do that if you take the itemized deduction, and only one-third of taxpayers take that. So for two-thirds of American taxpayers, even though it's there, they don't get it. And among homeowners, only 20% take the mortgage interest deduction. And, of course, they're the richest 20%. Terry, this deduction costs $103 billion a year. We offer it as a subsidy to the richest homeowners in America. And the argument is, well, we need this to enhance home ownership. No, as a matter of fact. Australia, Canada, Germany, Israel, Japan, Netherlands, New Zealand, etc., they took away the mortgage interest deduction, and guess what? Higher rates of homeownership than we have. There's no indication at all that this thing does its purported purpose, which is to enhance homeownership. And it's only people buying the most expensive homes who get this break. The net result, as I said, $103 billion a year we don't get that could reduce the deficit.
And do you challenge whether it's fair to give a break to homeowners and not to people who rent?
Well, that's another issue. Renters, they pay the mortgage of the landlord, but only the landlord gets the tax break. So, yeah, that's not fair either. And that's why, you know, it used to be every country had this deduction. And as I said, almost all the rich countries have gotten rid of it and no drop in home ownership rates.
So let's look at charitable deductions. That's something that you and many people question. Is it worth it to the individuals who have the charitable deductions? Is it worth it to us as a culture who need taxes to fund the things we need done? So explain how charitable deductions work.
Okay, to lead into that, could I just tell you some of the things, many things you get a write-off for in our tax code? You get a write-off for taking a night school course, paying your property tax, growing sugarcane, moving to a new city, replanting a forest, destroying old farm equipment, employing Native Americans, or buying a plug-in hybrid sports car like a Tesla. And we just are full of these things. And one of the biggest ones is the charitable contribution deduction. It costs the Treasury about $73 billion a year. Again, money that you could use for helping veterans or building a border. And it doesn't serve its purpose. There's no evidence anywhere that the charitable interest deduction enhances charitable contributions. For one thing, the most common form of contribution in the United States is when people put $5 in the plate at church, or $10 in the collection box at the soccer club's dinner, and those are cash contributions. You can't write them off; they're not deductible. Many countries have gotten rid of the charitable deduction, and there's a pattern. For about 1 year or 2 years, there's a small blip, a drop in contributions, and after about 3 years, contributions keep going up at the rate of personal income going up. In other words, Terry, people give money to charities because they want to help others. to me, to give them a tax break for it, it just cheapens the charitable impulse. And also, here's one more thing. It is so subject to abuse. One of the biggest forms of charitable deduction is giving art to a museum. So you give an old picture to a museum, you hire an appraiser, and she knows that you and the museum both want the highest possible number. And then you write off this huge number. So the IRS has had to create its own department of art appraisal to judge these appraisals. And guess what? They happen to disagree with the taxpayer 85% of the time because people exaggerate this. Here's another one I really like. You can do fractional giving. You can give a painting to a museum for 3 months, you know, while you're in your summer home in the south of France. And then you come home, you put it back on your dining room wall, and you get a deduction for that. So the thing is really grossly misused, and it doesn't serve its purpose. It doesn't enhance charitable contributions. So
can I do a yes but here?
I
think for corporations and for wealthy families, they often create foundations or funds that give generously to nonprofit, arts, and other organizations. And those donations really help keep those organizations going. And mathematically, part of the reason for that is the tax deduction.
Yeah, so here's my answer to your yes, but. They would give the money to charities that they like, whether they got the deduction or not. I mean, what are they going to do? How many Bentleys can you buy?
Things don't work that way.
they want to help somebody.
They want profits for their shareholders. But truly, don't you think, like, for corporations and for very wealthy families, that the tax deduction really is an incentive for charitable giving?
Well, I think not. I think corporations want to help their community, and that's why they match, you know, they match gifts, because they want to steer their giving to where their employees want to help. I think they do it out of eleemosynary impulse. They want to help others. And the reason I think I'm right is because in my book, you can look at all these countries that got rid of the charitable deduction, and charitable contributions kept going up at about the same rate that income went up.
I just want to clarify, I'm not saying that wealthy families and profitable or corporations wouldn't give to charity. I just think there definitely is an incentive to do it, and it helps incentivize giving on that scale.
Well, I have to say the Council on Foundations and all charitable development officers would agree with you, but looking around the world, I would tell you I think that's wrong, that people give money because they want to help. If you take away the tax deduction for a year or two, they may not, and then they do again.
So let's look at what the Trump administration is likely to be proposing, which includes lowering corporate taxes. So what do you know so far about what President Trump would like to see done?
Our current corporate tax is progressive, but most companies pay at the top rate, 35%. That's just about the highest rate in the world. American companies are being taxed higher than their competitors overseas. Nobody really pays the 35%, but even if you take the effective rate, that is what people really pay, it's higher for American corporations than elsewhere. This is not working. Corporations spend tens of millions of dollars to find ways to move their profits somewhere else so they don't pay the tax. And the result is, even with this high rate of tax, the corporate income tax is now a pretty minor portion of government revenues. In the 1960s, one-third of all revenue came from the corporate income tax. Now it's about 8% because they've gotten so good at ducking it. So it's just not working. It's an unfair competitive disadvantage. We really ought to cut it. And there are various proposals. The Democrats have proposed 35% down to 25%. The major House plan says 20%. And Donald Trump, of course, 15%.
So would there be ways of ensuring corporations actually paid it if you lowered the taxes?
Well, one theory
is, because you're saying there's so many ways to duck out of paying the money. So there's so many like exemptions. You can offshore the money. You could set up, you know, basically fake companies to get around paying taxes.
They all do. I mean, they're very good at it. I think any chief financial officer who ever paid the 35% tax rate would be fired the next morning. None of them does that. Yeah, just like with the individual income tax, the corporate income tax is studded with loopholes and giveaways and exemptions and credits. There are laws passed by Congress because if you give enough money to your congressperson, she will put in the bill. And it's so obscure that most other people don't fight it. They want to maybe want to do a favor for one of their constituents down the road. There are hundreds of them in there. And we could dump them. And if we dump them, then we could lower the corporate income tax rate. You know, if you have to pay tax at 35% or even the effective rate about 26%, well, then it's worth it to hire a lawyer or consultant and spend millions to cut your tax bill. If we got a lower rate and got rid of all those giveaways, then companies would probably pay the tax because it would be cheaper than finding a way to avoid it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is T.R. Reid, author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is T.R. Reid, author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax. It examines our tax codes and those of other countries to see if there are ways to overhaul our tax system to make it simpler, fairer, and more efficient. So one of the things you found that a lot of countries have, which we don't in America, is the VAT, the value-added tax. Would you explain what the value-added tax is?
Yeah, this is the most important innovation in taxation in the last 60 years. This is a tax that's like a sales tax on steroids. It's a tax. Our sales tax is called a retail sales tax. The tax is only collected when the retailer sells you the book. But on a value-added tax, a tax is collected when the paper mill sells the paper to the publisher. And when the publisher buys ink from an ink company, and then the publisher sells it to a wholesaler, and a wholesaler sells it to a distributor, distributor to the bookstore, and the bookstore to you, that tax is collected at every level. And every time you pay the tax to the other guy, you report it to the government to get a credit for the tax you paid, which means every penny of tax that's paid is reported to the government. So the VAT turns out to be a very easy tax for government to collect and a very hard tax for taxpayers to avoid. And so if you put in a value-added tax, they're very steady collections, and it's hard to cheat on, and you can use that money to reduce the rate of the corporate or the personal income tax. So 176 countries have adopted this innovation. It's a great idea. The only countries that don't have it are a bunch of countries so poor they have no taxes, and the United States of America. So I say in my book, in taxation, Americans are still banging out letters on a typewriter and dropping them in a mailbox, and everybody else is texting and using Instagram.
One of the objections to the VAT in the U.S. is that it raises the price of goods because every stop along the way, when the goods change hands in the production process and then the sales, there's a tax that's added so that those taxes really mount up by the time you're purchasing the product.
That's a fair criticism. It does add to the price of things and creates some inflation, particularly when you first put it in. But as I said, you use those revenues to offset the income tax. So people pay less on April 15th or they have less withheld from their paycheck and they come out fine. For the government, it's easier to collect, so you need less bureaucracy collecting the tax. And here's the other thing. This is a tax that doesn't tax savings, it doesn't tax work, doesn't tax investment, it taxes spending, and economists like that. So that's why so many countries have it. I went to New Zealand, and they got around to it about 1994. And the finance minister said to me, you know, I knew we needed a VAT, but I couldn't call it the VAT. And the reason is every Kiwi who goes to Britain on vacation has to pay the value-added tax, and they hate the VAT. So he produced the same tax, but he called it the GST, the Goods and Services Tax. And I said, really, you tax services? He says, yeah, lawyers, interior designers, lawnmowers, you know, we tax all the services.
So one more thing about the VAT, it's not a progressive tax. Everybody pays it. So, you know, people who are poor are paying the same amount on goods and services as people who are rich.
Yeah, that's a real problem. It could be a problem. It's a regressive tax. There are two ways to deal with that. One is you exempt stuff that people need, food, medicine, textbooks, diapers, stuff like that. That makes the tax more complicated, but it's less regressive for lower income people. I think the better way to deal with that is you charge the same tax for everything, and then on the income tax, you give people a credit at a certain income level for the VAT they paid. That would work, and it helps people out. But this is a reason why liberals don't like the VAT. They think it's regressive. As a matter of fact, in most countries, it doesn't work that way. Conservatives don't like the VAT because they call it, are you ready? They call it the money machine. You can raise so much money with it that it bodes higher taxes. But in fact, when you raise the money with the VAT, then you should use that revenue to lower the income tax rate.
My guest is journalist T.R. Reid, author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. After a break, we'll talk about the current politics of taxes as President Trump tries to move forward on his promise to overhaul the tax system. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Stitch Fix, a personal styling service for women and men. Clients get hand-picked clothing, accessories, and footwear delivered to their door. They keep what they like and send back the rest. Learn more at stitchfix.com. And from Right at Home, dedicated to improving the quality of life for seniors and the disabled by providing in-home care services ranging from rides to the doctor to health monitoring. The right care, right at home. Learn more at rightathome.net/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist T.R. Reid. His new book, A Fine Mess, is about America's complicated tax code and what other countries can teach us about how to make it simpler, fairer, and more efficient. He's also been following President Trump's tax proposals and the reactions of Democrats and Republicans. From what you've heard so far, what stands out in what Republicans are discussing to propose in the tax plan?
Well, I think they're definitely going to cut the corporate tax rate. Now, everybody wants to do that, and it ought to be done. It makes sense. The question is whether they will pay for it, pay for the lost revenue by eliminating exemptions or with the border tax or something. You know, if you look at the history of what Congress does, generally they don't pay for it. They give tax breaks, they cut revenues, and just add to the deficit.
So there's constantly calls in the world of tax overhaul to decrease capital gains tax. Would you explain how capital gains tax work?
Yeah. Let's say you're an executive at an auto company and you're paid a salary And, you know, if you're paid pretty well, you're going to pay up to the top rate of 39.6%. That's labor income, and it's taxed at that rate. But if you make your money trading stock in auto companies, well, no matter how much you make, those people pay tax at a lower rate. For most people, the capital gains tax, top tax, is 20%, about half the rate of a rich person on labor income. And the argument for it is, well, it's risky. It's risky to invest in a company, so we got to give people a tax break to encourage them to do it. And what I found around the world is some countries have a lower rate for capital gains. A few countries have no tax on capital gains. But most countries have leveled it off so that the tax on labor and the tax on capital income are the same. And guess what? There's no significant drop in investment or stock prices when you tax the same.
You refer to the BBLR, the broad-based low-rate approach to taxes. Explain what that means.
Well, I went to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and said to them, what makes a good tax code? Who's got one? And they said, we know, fairly simple formula, BBLR. That means broaden the base so you can lower the rates. Broaden the base means you make everything taxable. You got a paycheck, that's taxable. Your employer pays your health insurance premium, well, that's income to you. We're going to tax that. Your employer gives you free parking, well, that would cost $20 a month. That's taxable. And then no deductions. You want to give money to charity? Boy, that's great. We're all for it, but we're not going to give you a tax break. You have mortgage interest? Fine, but we're not going to give you a tax break. And if you do that, that broadens the base, and then you can lower the rates way down. And several countries have done this, and there's a trade-off. So people lose their cherished deduction. Oh, my God, don't broaden my base. I want my deduction. And the carrot is we're going to give you a lower rate. So in America, a family at the median income, if you take their income tax, their Social Security tax, their Medicaid tax, and their health insurance, is paying about 35%. In New Zealand, income tax, Social Security, health care, and education, 17.5% for that same family. And the reason is they broadened the definition of income. They took away all the giveaways. And if you do that, you can get the rates way down, and it makes your tax return much easier. You don't have to fill in 50 lines on all the stuff you want for an exemption.
So who's tried that?
New Zealand did it. Australia did it. Britain did it in a pretty serious way. The Germans did it to a degree. Many countries, South Korea, are moving in this direction because of two things. First, you get the lower rate. And if you have lower rates, compliance is better. People are more likely to pay a tax bill if it's 12% than if it's 40%. And second, it's much simpler. So that's the trade-off. You get rid of cherished deductions, you get a lower rate.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist T.R. Reid. His new book is called A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AMC, presenting their new original series, The Sun, starring Pierce Brosnan, a multi-generational saga depicting the birth and rise of oil, Texas, and America. Premieres Sunday, April 8th at 9, 8 Central on AMC. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is T.R. Reid, author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. It examines our tax code and those of other countries to see if there are ways to overhaul our tax code to make it simpler, fairer, and more efficient. So the people who write the tax codes, they're politicians. And there are competing political philosophies of what taxes should do, how high they should be, how big government, which is supported by taxes, should be. Can you describe some of the opposing philosophies of taxation that we're seeing played out now as a tax overhaul proposal is about to be presented?
Yes, well, we saw part of that philosophical disagreement in the argument over the health bill. The question is, how much role should government have in health care? How much role should government have in cleaning up the environment? How much role should government have in regulating businesses? And, you know, a lot of Americans really don't like the idea of big government. Get it out of my life. And if you cut the size of government, then theoretically you can cut the taxes that pay for government.
What are some of the opposing philosophies within the Republican Party right now?
Well, some Republicans want to sharply cut rates on individuals. Some say the thing to do is sharply cut rates on corporations. And in order to pay for that cut, we'd have to keep a fairly steady flow of income from individuals. Many Republicans think we should sharply cut or eliminate taxes on investment and capital gains because that generates the investment we need to grow the economy. Republicans are all over the map, and guess what? So are Democrats. There's really not much consensus, but there was a time in the United States when we had consensus, 1986.
So what happened in 1986?
A Republican, conservative Republican president, Ronald Reagan, and a very liberal House of Representatives led by Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts agreed on a major change in U.S. taxes. And here's what they did. They took away all sorts of exemptions and deductions, and that broadened the base. And then they were able to lower the rates. In the 1980s, the top marginal rate in income tax went from 70% to 28%. Brought in the same revenue because they got rid of all the other stuff. In other words, the pain of losing the deductions was offset by the gain of the lower rates, and that's how you do tax reform. A guy in New Zealand told me when they rewrote their tax code, he said the most important thing was don't do it piece by piece. You got to do it big. You got to do the whole thing. And then for everything somebody doesn't like in the change, there's something else they do, and you can pass it. And that's how the U.S. could do it.
You quote something that Donald Trump said before he became president, which is that the U.S. is the highest tax country in the world. Is that true?
That's an alternative fact, Terry. As a matter of fact, if you take the standard measure of tax burden, it's called overall tax burden. The United States is one of the lowest taxed of all the rich countries in the world. Overall tax burden, the International Monetary Fund computes this. You take all the federal, state, and local taxes paid in the whole country, add them all up, and take them as a percentage of GDP, of overall wealth. By that measure, of the 35 richest countries, the U.S. ranks 32nd. We pay much lower taxes. We pay lower gas taxes, tobacco taxes, income taxes, Social Security taxes, sales taxes.
And we don't have a value-added tax.
We don't have a VAT. If we did, our sales tax would presumably be higher. No, we're a low tax and a low effort. They describe it as low effort. If you don't collect much of the wealth in your country in tax, that's called low effort. I don't know if that makes anybody feel better as they're struggling with Form 1040, but you're paying less than a German would. You're paying less than a Brit would, even though it's harder to pay here. The places we're higher are the corporate income tax, where we have almost the highest rate in the world, and the estate tax. This is a tax that's paid by rich people when they die and their heirs have to pay the tax. If you remember, the critics have called this the death tax. But I think that's wrong because it's the living heir who pays. It's the lucky rich kid who did nothing and inherited $50 million.
How much does your estate have to be worth before you pay the estate tax?
If you're single, $5.5 million. If you're married and leave half of it to the spouse, $11 million. 1 in 70,000 Americans has to pay the estate tax. So I think it's a good tax. It doesn't tax labor. It doesn't tax investment. It only taxes lucky people who can afford to pay it. But interestingly, several countries that we would consider pretty lefty have eliminated the estate tax recently. Sweden has no estate tax. Canada got rid of the estate tax. And the slogan in Canada to dump the estate tax, I really like this, was no taxation without respiration.
So Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, is going to try to get through, you know, a tax overhaul in Congress. How would you describe his philosophy of taxation and how that's combined with his philosophy of government?
Yeah, well, Paul Ryan, like many Republicans, wants a smaller government. There are a lot of things government does, like providing health care, that he thinks the private sector could probably do better. So he wants government to get out of the way, and he wants government to get out of our personal income and not tax it so much. And so he has a plan that would cut rates for all corporations and would cut rates for all individuals. So far, we have not seen in Paul Ryan's Better Way plan how he would make up for the lost revenue. At the moment, it just seems to add to the deficit, but that's also contrary to Republican principles. So they need to come up with a way to broaden the base if they're going to lower the rates so they can bring in the same revenue. At the moment, that doesn't exist. And, you know, it's kind of the same pattern we saw on the health care reform, Terry. They had a plan, but the numbers never added up because they never really filled in all the blanks. And so far, that's the case with the Republican tax plan, too.
There are two impulses that seem to be in direct contradiction, two impulses within the Republican Party and conservatives. One is cut taxes, and the other is cut the deficit. But if you have less money coming in, the deficit is going to grow unless you cut a lot of government, which is usually on the table too. So I think it's fair to say that the Republican proposal will have cutting taxes, cutting the deficit, and also cutting a lot of services and agencies in government. What do you think the biggest conflicts are going to be over?
Well, so far their plans don't cut the deficit because all the money they're saving on civilian agencies, they're putting into a bigger military. They're going to build a whole new aircraft carrier task force, et cetera. So, so far from what we've seen, they don't cut the deficit. President Trump released this budget outline, and it didn't say anything about revenues. It just said what they were going to spend. So we don't know. But so far, we don't see any plan to cut the deficit. Basically, if you want to cut taxes for everybody, you can't cut the deficit. If you want to cut the deficit, you got to keep your tax revenues the same. If you want to spend more on the military, it's very hard to cut the deficit. So, you know, Terry, we always get these plans on paper. I'm going to cut this. I'm going to cut that. The classic term is waste and fraud. We're going to cut waste and fraud, and that's going to magically balance the budget. I hate to say it, but it's never worked.
So Ted Cruz, when he was running for president, wanted to eliminate the IRS. Is that a popular proposal? Does that have any support?
When people say, I'm going to eliminate the IRS, crowds cheer. I mean, it's ridiculous. Somebody's going to collect the tax. I mean, Ted Cruz wants to be paid for being a member of the Senate. Ted Cruz wants a strong military. We got to pay for that some way. Taxes is how we pay for it, and somebody has to collect the tax. You could change the name, the People's Service Bureau, instead of the Internal Revenue Service, but somebody's going to be there, whether you call it the IRS or not.
Has the IRS shrunken in recent years?
Yeah, I think this is really dumb. According to the IRS figures, they spend 35 cents for every $100 they bring in. In other words, it's the only federal agency that brings in more than it costs. You would think as a business proposition, you wouldn't cut your biggest profit center, right? Wouldn't you make it bigger and take in more? But to punish the IRS because Americans don't like taxes and Republicans particularly don't like taxes, they've been cutting the budget. The result is many fewer audits, fewer answers to taxpayer questions, and much lower collections than we would have with a bigger staff. So I just don't see shrinking the IRS. You can't shrink the IRS and expect to bring in enough money to cut the deficit. Those two don't go together.
Are you concerned that in fixing the tax code, we might fix it in a direction that will favor the rich more than they're favored now and will add to the debt?
That's how things seem to work in the United States, because our Supreme Court, no other court in the world has said this, our Supreme Court has said that giving money is the same thing as free speech, and therefore it's hard to limit. And sure enough, rich people invest in politicians to get the things they want. But, you know, if you go back to 1986, although rich people got a much lower rate, they lost a lot of the goodies they used to have, because Congress stood up to them and said the only way we can make our tax code work is to make it apply equally to everybody. So if we could get that mindset in the U.S. Congress and the White House, yeah, we could. But I hate to say it, but generally in the U.S. Congress, rich people get what they want.
So if you were designing the tax code from scratch, what would it look like?
Our tax code would have virtually no exemptions, deductions, credits, giveaways, and therefore it would have very low rates. Rates, say, from 5 to 12 or 15% for individuals, maybe 5 to 18% for corporations. We'd raise the same revenue because the base would be broader and it would be much simpler to pay. I would have the IRS fill in the form for almost all taxpayers. So all you had to do is check the numbers and say, yeah. And then April 15th would be just another sunny spring day. And I think we definitely have to pick up this great new innovation, the value-added tax. It taxes consumption, not labor. It's easy to collect. It's hard to evade. And it lets you cut the rates of all the other taxes.
Well, I wish you good luck on filing your taxes. I wish that to our listeners as well. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great to be on your air again. Thanks, Terry.
T.R. Reid is the author of the new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Valerie June is a Tennessee-born singer-songwriter who made a splash with her 2013 album, Pushing Against a Stone. On her latest album, The Order of Time, Valerie June reaches back to her roots in Southern gospel, reconciling it with her current life in Brooklyn, New York. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
It's been a few years since we've heard that Valerie June voice, the high-pitched twang that toggles back and forth between crisp enunciation and a slurred drawl. On the song I just played, called Shakedown, she's joined by two brothers and her father on backup vocals. The song builds to a rock band rave-up, but in the midst of all that, Valerie June sounds as lonely as if she was singing to herself in an empty room. On this album, The Order of Time, June is especially effective when she gets that alone-in-a-room sound going. Listen to the way her voice seems to bounce off the walls of a heartbreak hotel room on a song called If And.
Some things in life happen too slow. Sometimes you don't know it's ready to go. One thing for sure, one thing that's real.
Elsewhere, June's voice takes a slow crawl away from the wreckage of a romance on the song Love You Once Made. Beginning with just vocal and bass, the melody is soon joined by an organ and drums. An electric piano flutters around June's voice as she sings about a faded love that always threatens to loom up in front of her, the memory newly fresh and painful.
You can leave now, you did all you could. You could have said 10,000 words, done all the things that you should. But time's hands turn to point straight your way. A memory faded to dust of a love you once made.
Born in Tennessee in the early 80s, listening to gospel music in her church and getting exposed to soul, blues, and rock from her music promoter father, Valerie June moved to Memphis to start her performing career, playing guitar and banjo as well as singing. A few years ago, she relocated to Brooklyn, but that hasn't turned her into a jaded hipster. Just listen to the glowing wonder she brings to Astral Plane. It's a song that treats the spiritual and the mystical as being as substantial as the guitar she strums.
Is there a light you have inside you can't touch? A looking glass can only show you so much. Follow the signs, slowly but steady, don't rush. The day will come when you're ready, just trust. Dancing on the astral plane, holy water cleansing rain.
One of my favorite songs on this album is Just In Time. It sounds like a New York piece of music. Its beat might have been lifted from the Shangri-La's girl group. Its violin and cello, a minimalist version of a Phil Spector production. Her voice, the sound of a solo doo-wop act. The title Just In Time quickly takes on an added meaning, wiping away the distance between different decades of music to make the song seem of its time and timeless. Just In Time, the album title The Order of Time. June's sense of time as fluid and multidimensional is all over this collection. It's something close to what science fiction writers call a time slip, a notion she gets at on a soul ballad here called Slip Slide On By. Yet for all this, Valerie June resists becoming too airy or ethereal. She also understands the way certain pop genres, certain ways to phrase and shape a lyric, can break and mend a heart at the same time.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed The Order of Time by singer-songwriter Valerie June. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, punk rocker Laura Jane Grace will talk with us about how transitioning from male to female affected her music, her fans, her marriage, her daughter, and her own identity. Grace is the founder of the band Against Me. Last year, she burned her birth certificate at a concert in North Carolina, saying, "Goodbye, gender. I hope you'll join us." Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Angie's List, for more than 20 years helping consumers select local service providers, dedicated to promoting fairness and transparency about local pricing and quality, at angieslist.com. Angie's List, home is where our heart is. And from Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.